Okay, can we make a start, please? Can I say, first of all, welcome. Welcome to sunny Newcastle, the not-so-frozen sunny northeast. If you've travelled a lot, I know you've all travelled a long way to get here, so I'm very grateful for that. Welcome to people in Wiltshire. Is it sunny in Wiltshire?
Yes, it is.
It is sunny in Wiltshire, that's good. You're about halfway up the country from here, by the way. I know you've come a long way, but if you think about, you know, Southampton up to the top of Scotland, you're about halfway. You might think you're further up, but that's where you are. So still a long way to go. But from my perspective, I just hope that individually, collectively, you have a fantastic couple of days. I hope you have a great tour this afternoon. Signed up for the guided tour around the city. And ready to start with a video link with Dyson. So if they're ready, we're ready to go. You go on, mate?
Thanks. Good afternoon, friends and colleagues. It's my great pleasure to chair this session where we have a link with Dyson Research and Development, and a particular warm welcome to Ben and to Sarah. I understand that you both have advance warning of the questions. And just to clarify what's going to happen, I will read out each question, and I understand you will then take it in turn to give an answer. Just to give you some background, the room is dripping with talented experts from the world of design and technology. And we also have with us some advisors, inspectors, and consultants. Time is precious, so without further ado, I'll remind the audience of the first question. Did D&T in school influence your career choice? If not, what should we change? What do you see as appropriate preparation in schools in order to produce good designers?
Things like links with physics, and Sarah's mentioned to me about, you know, potentially getting links in with human geography. There's obviously a fairly strong link with mathematics as well. But trying to get projects where maybe you could draw on some of the stuff that they're learning in their science classes as well, that could be of quite benefit. So yeah, that's something to look at.
I'd just like to add, I'd say that my career in design was actually a career change. And if I had had careers advice whilst I was at school and understood the different areas of design that I could have gone into, I think I would have made the right choice straight away.
Thanks very much. Unfortunately, we can't come back at you with further questions. However, we move on to question two. James Dyson is known for his experience of developing his first vacuum machine. How do you develop your products now, and what can education learn from your method of working?
We develop technology to solve problems. So a lot of our products are very technology-led. We have, I think it's about 420 scientists and engineers here that are constantly looking at new ways of doing things. Also, our products are designed specifically for various markets. For instance, the DC-12 that I think you can see on the table in front of us was designed to answer specific problems in the Japanese market, looking at Japanese culture. We developed the Dyson Digital Motor, which is a small, very highly powered motor that spins at 100,000 RPM to fit into this small, easy-to-store product. So it's a sort of technology-driven market pull design process.
Yeah, I think the only thing I'd add into that is the fact that generally we do follow the kind of standard design process pretty closely from what I remember in school. The only difference there is obviously some of our projects we can afford to keep going. So although our typical design cycle might be 18 months, something like that, depending upon the complexity of the project, some of our other projects have been going for kind of 8 years or more. with us trying to get them right. So it's a bit different in that respect, in that we can afford to keep going with something if we truly believe in it. We're obviously we're not constrained by a kind of calendar year or when exam results need to be in. But generally, kind of the design cycle is very close. The only thing that we do quite a lot of, which is some people find quite surprising, is we do an awful lot of cardboard modelling. I don't know if you can see this model here, but there's a few models of our latest handheld machine. And it kind of shows, there's a couple of different models which are all cardboard and bits of cut-up plastic from the workshop, which take, you know, literally hours to put together, and you can do lots of different ideas very quickly. And this is something we make an awful lot of use of, even though we've got facilities to do kind of very high-end SLS and SLA rapid prototyping products, and we do that at later stages. The very early design stage is done like this, so you don't need any, you know, any specialist equipment or anything like that.
Thank you for that. Because of time constraints, I've been alerted to the fact that we're missing out the third question on your sheet, and we'll move on to question four, which is, what should we develop in schools to support British industry or to keep the UK at the leading edge of design and technology? And what links with school do you think are valuable?
We do a lot of, as Ben's pointed out, a lot of rig building, a lot of prototyping. So very hands-on skills, sort of quick proving out concepts, proving out technology, then presenting again to our peers and managers to try and establish whether a technology is robust. So it's a very sort of quick iterative process. So being able to build rigs quickly, present well, sketching, we do a lot of sketching, a lot of visual communication to each other. Final model making as well, so that you can really get a firm flavour of a product and the sort of human interactions with it, so you can sort of do user trials and get good robust feedback as to whether your product's working for its end user. And obviously we use a lot of CAD as well, so all those sort of processes should be encouraged in schools, so that people are designing real products for real people. Also link ups with live projects, with live real, you know, national and local companies. So students have a real concept of you know, working in a sort of industrial environment. I think also manufacturing processes as well. There's not so much manufacturing that's done in Britain. So when you get into the an industrial working environment, understanding those manufacturing processes in advance is a real skill. Anything you'd like to add?
No, I think that was pretty good.
Okay.
He's always pretty good as well. Just wanted you to know our audience are alive. James Dyson famously said, good design is about how something works, not how it looks. And this is the question presented. Dyson has developed a reputation for producing brightly coloured domestic products. Is this part of a marketing gimmick, or is it fundamental to the product being produced? And there's a second part of the question. How far do you consider the cultural or sustainability issues in product development?
Do you want to take this one?
Yeah, I think if I kind of answer the first part of it first, there was certainly an aspect of the fact that our machines were brightly coloured, I think gave us an advantage in the fact that when we launched the first DC01 in the UK, all of our competitors were kind of brown, grey or black boxes that looked very much like each other. And it meant that we did stand out quite vividly in a shop, which obviously gave us an advantage there. But the way that that's moved on now is very much to help us try and identify what the key technology is inside the product, and also help the user with trying to identify where the switches are. I think lots of products now are becoming, as they become more sort of technologically advanced, there's more and more features, and I think some people get quite scared of using them. And so we try and soften that down a bit by trying to make the big user interaction kind of interfaces, so all the important buttons and catches and switches, they stand out in a bright colour so that people can find them easily. And then also there might be a colour to attract people to the core technology, so what they're actually investing their money in, so they can see, you know, where the hard-earned cash is going.
And then on the environmental side, the sustainability side, we have an environmental manager here at Dyson who is constantly looking at the sort of environmental impact and ways of reducing that of our products. We also believe that the most effective way of reducing the environmental impact of our products is the longevity of the product life cycle. So we rigorously test our products to make sure that they will give the user the best possible life from that product, and now so confident in our reliability that we offer a 5-year guarantee. Also, there's the WE directive, which is a new initiative that's just come in, which we, of course, are complying with. And then final point is all the products that we can get back in, we do, and rework them and are sold to staff as B and C grade. So, you know, we already have started recycling our own products.
Well, so far you've been incredibly interesting and very succinct. So hopefully we have time to offer the final question, which was question 3 in those sent to you earlier, and it's, how do Dyson predict future products or future markets, and what is your mechanism for making the decision for which your ideas are to be developed in full?
Well, we have global teams that are constantly looking at how markets are developing around the world. We, as I said earlier, we're constantly developing new technologies to work in floor care and other products. So we're it's a case of iterative design, really. We're looking for problems to solve and looking for technologies that can solve those problems. And we continue to review a product's sort of potential success in solving those problems throughout the process. And as Ben mentioned earlier, we have some projects that we've been working on for 8 years or so that we can be constantly evaluating and wondering, you know, when's the right time to launch that product and will it still meet the market needs. Anything to add on that, Ben?
The only thing I can think of really is that there's certain aspects of certain cultural differences. Certainly, as Sarah mentioned earlier, the products that we sell in Japan tend to be smaller. Their houses are smaller and they have much less space. And also, the kind of floor types are different, so that we've got to consider that tatami matting, for instance. Or in Europe, there are far more hard floors than there are carpets, and which is what we used to in the UK. So there's quite a lot of differences, which you might not think are there, but have quite a big influence on how we design our products and where we decide to put those products in terms of the market.
Thanks for that. We've run out of formal questions, but we have 5 minutes left, and as far as I'm concerned, the time is too precious to just finish now. Are you happy to take some off-the-cuff comments or questions from me?
Of course, please do.
Yes. Thanks. Not really a question, but to give you some opportunity to sort of busk it, would you like to tell us anything about, I'll give you a selection, one, perhaps the new Airblade hand dryer, or the new designers show, which I know that, I think, Sarah, that's where you were found, as it were. Your talent is glittering, and I think the BBC and James Dyson recognised you at wonderful capabilities and potential, and that's why you're there now. So you may like to say something about the new designers show. Some of these audience haven't heard of it. I said that, you know, that we've got some mixed ability groups here. And finally, you may want to talk about perhaps one of the most exciting things to happen in education, and that would be the new Dyson School of Design and Innovation. So any of those three, we'd be happy to hear from you.
Well, the new designer show is a design show that it happens in London once a year. It's organised by colleges and universities as a showcase, and James Dyson Foundation do a design award there, and it was there that I met the team at Dyson who invited me to come along for an interview. So it's more of a university's than a school's show.
I think the quite interesting thing about the new designers, as far as I was concerned, and certainly it's a bit of an indication of where James's passion lies, was that when I exhibited there some years ago, James came round, and there's obviously an awful lot of products there to review from a lot of universities, but he actually spent no time at all on the stands of the universities who were only doing visual models. So he wanted to see models that were working. He wanted to see the function. He wanted people to be able to understand what needed to go into that product and all the kind of the manufacturing limitations and capabilities of it. So that's quite an interesting thing to know, is that there were some very beautiful looking products there, but if the designer didn't know how they were going to be built, he wasn't interested.
Mm. They were very interested in the ways that I'd tested my product, new designers, and now I actually work here, I can see how rigorously things are tested here. So testing a concept and the final product is something we're very keen on.
I'm going to squeeze every second out of this session. So would you like to comment on Airblade or the new School of Design and Innovation?
Don't really know which one to tackle, but I can talk about Airblade. I probably know a little bit more about that than the school at the moment. But it's a product that we kind of developed almost by accident. We developed the Dyson Digital Motor, which Sarah had spoken about earlier, for the Japanese product, which is a very small and powerful motor. And it was during some testing of that somebody noticed that the exhaust flow from that motor, because it spins so fast and has such a large volume of air flowing through it very quickly, was quite a substantial blast. So we tried a few different things and eventually found out that if you exhausted this motor through a very narrow slot, you got this blade of air coming out very quickly. And that developed into looking at what we could do with that and found out that it would very effectively wipe the water from your hands. So rather than conventional hand dryers, which I think everybody's experienced walking out with wet hands still after a minute, unlike those which use evaporation to try and heat the water and evaporate off your hands, this actually blasts the water straight from your skin. So there's no heat involved, apart from the little bit that's generated by the motor, which makes it very fast and very, very efficient.
Also, using our expertise in filters and separation, the air that's sucked from the bathrooms that's traditionally just blown straight onto your hands is actually filtered and sanitised before it hits your hands. So we've managed to use two of our current technologies in the Airblade.
Perfect timing. I'm sure the audience would want me to thank Ben and Sarah for a very dynamic and interesting introduction to our conference. So thank you to colleagues at Dyson Research and Development from colleagues here in Newcastle.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.